Hello and welcome to the Black Ladder podcast, a collection of conversations with interesting Black individuals who not only do amazing work but are consciously helping others to climb the career ladder too. We'll be sitting on my sofa talking about what they do, how they got there, lessons learned along the way, and what being Black in their workplace means to them. I'm your host Ife, bringing you life without the L. Hope you're comfy, let's get to it. Today's guest is Kenzo Onumonu. Kenzo is a lawyer who works as a senior legal counsel for a venture capitalist. Outside of his 9-to-5, Kenzo is also the creator of 4T, a card game that's designed to get people talking and sparks important conversations. It was great to talk about the different external influences that can affect your chances of becoming a lawyer, and we came to the conclusion that some of these influences are already in play from a very young age. On this week's episode, Kenzo tells us about the differences between solicitors and barristers, the key stakeholders of a lawyer, working in a creative startup company, and why representation is important. Hi Kenzo, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. So today's all about perseverance because we have persevered to get this, and I personally pushed to get it because his story is really amazing and I'm excited to get it out to everybody. And this is our second time of recording, but it's going to be banging. It's going to be really good. So
I'm fingers crossed for sure.
Okay. So because obviously we want to get to know you, everyone wants to find out a little bit more about you and what you're going to be talking about today. We're going to do the quick fire round. First question is, what's your name?
Kenzo Onumonu.
And what's your job title?
Senior legal counsel.
What motivates you?
Creating something that engages me and makes a difference.
Nice. Now let's rewind back a little bit and let's think, what did you want to be when you were younger?
That is a very good question. The unrealistic answer is probably centre midfielder for Arsenal. The realistic answer is probably just to work for myself. I didn't think I had kind of like a defined career path or strategy from a young age.
Now, to work for yourself, was that because you saw other people? Were you around people who were working for themselves? Or did you just think, one day I'm going to work for myself?
No, it's probably just to have the kind of creative freedom to be able to try different things out and to create something from nothing. I think that was what was super exciting for me.
Create something from nothing. That's quite an exciting concept for sure. So next question is, what was your first ever job?
Wow. My first ever job was working at Evans Cycles in Chiswick, where I grew up.
What was your role at Evans Cycle?
Junior shop assistant, which for anybody who's worked in retail is the freshest of the freshers, for sure.
Nice. So you were supplying the streets with what do they call them, wheels in some way?
Correct, yeah. Whilst incredibly not knowing anything about bicycles. So yeah, one of my achievements for sure.
Okay, tell us a bit about your education. So I guess maybe in your case, let's start around A-levels.
Right, so I actually didn't do A-levels. So I went to a school in Richmond in Surrey for kind of year 7 to year 11, so 11 to 16, and that school didn't have a sixth form. So then I went on a scholarship to a boarding school called King Edward's in Surrey. Okay. My intention was for me to go to Richmond College, where all my friends were going at the time. But my mum sort of said, you've got a place at this school. I turned up on the first day expecting to do A-levels, and they told me I'd be doing the International Baccalaureate. So yeah, wow. I didn't end up doing A-levels, which was a shock to me.
How many years did you do that for?
So that was for 2 years, and that was quite an interesting one, because A-levels are typically 3 or 4 subjects, and this was 6 plus kind of like an extracurricular part to it as well.
Oh my gosh. What were those subjects?
So you could pick from a range of subjects, but you basically have to do 3 subjects in more depth and 3 subjects in less depth. So for my higher level subjects, if you like, I ended up choosing history, English, and philosophy. And then I did maths, Spanish, and biology. That was it.
Wow.
I always forget.
My gosh, that is some serious stuff.
Yeah, very, very intense for sure. But fun. I mean, when you've just come from GCSEs, you don't really know too much difference. If anything, I was actually doing less subjects than I did the year before. So then I went off to university, and probably a silly decision, but I didn't actually go and look or visit any university before I turned up to the one that I ended up choosing. So with the IB, you get your results in May, I think it is. So a bit earlier than, you know, your A-level students. So fortunately got into the universities I applied for. And there were a few boys in the year above me at school that were on the same football team. And they essentially said that Exeter University, where I ended up going, had a decent football team. So that's where I went, and that was it.
Wow, okay. I like that. The boys said they had a good football team and you went there. So what degree did you study?
So I did law undergraduate.
Ah, okay. And did you do any form of any other education after that, or was that it?
So like that masters? That was it for undergraduate. And no, I didn't do a master's. So typically, if you want to go on to become a lawyer, you have to do a legal practice course. Or if you haven't done a law degree, you have to do a conversion course. Fortunately, because I'd done a law degree, I didn't need to do a conversion course. And then I guess the next question is, how do you fund the legal practice course? So how do you fund a law school? And you have to be sponsored, you have to have a training contract, unless you want to self-fund, of course, which most people don't end
up
doing.
It's a substantial amount, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's a serious investment, with no guarantee of a job if you haven't got a training contract offer. So that was the additional bit of studying that I did later down the line. But that was, you know, a few years after I'd left university.
Yeah. Now I'm going to take a wild guess. I hope I get this right. Did you do that course at BPP by any chance?
I didn't, no. So I'm one of the few people that did it at Kaplan Law School.
And final question of the quickfire round is, we actually discussed this earlier, but they want to know, because I know it, but they might not know it. But what's your favorite color?
Favorite color has to be black, which, as we discussed earlier, is actually kind of like, I guess, the absence of color. But yeah, I don't know. It just is.
It is what it is. You've got it. Everyone has a favorite color. I like
it. Yeah, for sure.
So we are back with part 2 of the Black Ladder podcast. And this is just going to be a run through of your career from the day you sort of left university or education all the way up till today. So you've got a great journey. So I think I'm going to let you start us off, because I always like to, I might kick in and here and there with some questions, but why don't you kick us off?
Sure. So from the end of university to where I am today. So when I left university, I fortunately had a job lined up. So whilst I was at university, I was the club captain of the football club, and fortunately had an idea whereby we could kind of monetize all of the partnerships that we had in and around the student community, basically, so with local shops and that sort of thing. And then pitched an idea to the university whereby they would use all of the blank space around your student logins page to advertise local businesses. And the university didn't go for it for external businesses, but they did sort of try and use it for internal campus shops and libraries and things like that. So when that sort of opportunity came about, there was another business in London that was doing something remotely similar with student campus space. So they were actually putting the Photo Me booths on campus. So you could, so you could go in and do a remote interview for, you know, KPMG or any other graduate recruiter that recruits en masse. So they effectively created Zoom before Zoom was a thing. So I kind of got in contact with them. I told them about what I'd been working on and they offered me a job. So that was my first job outside university. It was a bit of a shock, to be honest, because they had two parts and two arms of their business. They had the kind of corporate partnerships side, which I was very much involved in working on. And then they had a recruitment element. So that's how they kind of kept the lights on. They were making money through recruiting, and that was feeding into this kind of corporate partnership venture that they were working on.
Okay.
Which was quite interesting. So I learned a hell of a lot in that year, but that summer I was applying for vacation schemes and training contracts at law firms, and I fortunately got two places, one at a firm called Bird & Bird and one at a firm called Pinsent Masons. So I did both of those vacation schemes and ended up accepting the offer from Bird & Bird. So yeah, so the way these things work is that they will recruit you 2 years before you're due to start. And one of those years, you'll have to do your law school year. So I had a year to kill, if you like, before I did law school. So I then went to work as a paralegal in another law firm called Travis Smith.
Would you say that it was and is necessary to have that sort of summer internship with these companies to get a foot in the door?
I think it massively helps. And I think the biggest piece of advice I would give on whether it's necessary is that it's two-way. You kind of get to see what working in a law firm's like, whether it's for you. And the firm also gets to have a look at you as well, and to see whether you are suitable to offer a training contract or other kind of graduate job that you may be applying for. But I think it is useful. I guess if you're there every day, you can build relationships that you wouldn't otherwise be able to build if you just did a one-off interview. But it's not impossible. I do know people who did do one-off interviews and were successful. So yeah, it's just whichever one kind of works best for you and your personality.
Mm. So you're at Bird & Bird?
Yeah, so I was at Bird & Bird and I did my training contract, which is typically 24 months. But because of the paralegal experience that I'd had already, I did 18 months. So I did my first seat rotation, if you like, in the sports department. So I was on secondment to the Football Association for three of those 6 months. So posted up in Wembley. I say posted up, I mean, it wasn't in any way like chilled or relaxed or anything like that. It was a corporate job. But no, it was a really, you know, I love football. So it was amazing for me to be able to go and experience that and experience what law would be like outside of a law firm quite early on. And then, you know, also in the contentious part of the seat back at the law firm, getting involved in some really interesting cases. So Bird & Bird's sports department is sort of world renowned, really, and works on some of the most cutting edge sports litigation cases. There's a partner there called Jonathan Taylor, who it was great to work under, and it's great to get experience and learn in that department for sure.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. I mean, they've got all the contacts and all the different cases.
They're working on some pretty cool stuff over there. So they, you know, some of the Court of Arbitration for sport cases on, you know, doping and UK anti-doping cases and stuff, they will act for one party on. So yeah, it's a really good department. And then I went and joined the corporate department at Bird & Bird for my next 6 months, which was where I ended up kind of qualifying into. I'd had that sort of experience at Travis Smith as a corporate paralegal. So I was semi-familiar with the kind of law that I'd be doing. And it was super interesting to me because Bird & Bird focuses quite heavily on venture capital. So it was a really cool experience for somebody who's interested in business to kind of work closely with businesses trying to raise money or with investors trying to invest money.
At this point, I'm guessing you're a solicitor, right?
So, yeah. So I've just qualified. I think it was 2016.
What's the difference between a solicitor and a barrister? I know they're different, but I don't know what the difference really is. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, in very, very simple terms, I guess a solicitor will kind of construct, you know, the facts behind an argument, and a barrister will deliver it, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, that's a good explanation, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But a solicitor's job, depending on which kind of solicitor we're talking about, is far-reaching than just kind of getting the facts together for an argument. So for instance, you could have a commercial solicitor that advises businesses on different commercial transactions. You could have a property lawyer who advises people on kind of buying, selling property, whether that's kind of domestic or commercial property. So there are loads of different subsects of solicitor, and it's the same for barristers really, because some of them will be criminal barristers where they'll be, I guess, defending people who've been accused of crimes or breaking the law. And some of them will be commercial barristers. So they'll be involved in, let's say, you know, a litigation situation between two corporations, and it gets to a tribunal or it gets to, you know, a court, and there'll be a barrister kind of acting for each side. Very varied.
You've actually given us quite a good explanation there. That's super helpful, because when I've been watching Suits and different BBC programs, I'm always like, why are there two? Like, who's doing what? But that makes sense now.
Nice. Yeah, and it's a slightly different skill set, solicitors and barristers. And the ones that you will see on Suits and most shows, especially if they're English shows, will typically be barristers. So if they're addressing a judge in a court, yeah, they'll typically be a barrister.
Oh, so, okay, I'm going off topic here. Who talks to the judge? Is it the barrister or the solicitor?
That's the barrister that talks to the judge.
Ah, okay, got it. Yeah. This is interesting. Huh. Okay, so I interrupted you there. So keep going. Tell us what happens next. You're a Bird & Bird, you're a solicitor, you've qualified. What's going on?
So yeah, then it's just about kind of learning your trade. And I think most solicitors will tell you that when they start out, it's kind of a little bit daunting. Sometimes it's like, you know, you don't really know what you're doing for a little while until you've had the experience of doing it, if that makes sense. A partner once said to me kind of like, it's not something that you can just naturally know how to do. It's all about having the experience. So you're not going to know how to complete a transaction unless you've done one supervised, and then you've done another one supervised, and then you'll be able to kind of pick things up as you go along. So I guess in the early stages as a newly qualified solicitor, that's really what you're trying to do. You're trying to absorb as much information as possible and be as helpful as possible. So I spent March 2016 to July 2017. I was at Bird & Bird in the corporate department, mainly doing venture capital type work. And then in July 17, I went to work for Deliveroo in their legal team, which was kind of like a incredible opportunity, UK unicorn and a really fast growing, exciting company. Met some amazing people there as well. And, you know, it was just an incredible experience and so different from working in a law firm.
Yeah. I mean, basically you're coming from a law firm and you're moving to a tech company with a legal department, aren't you?
Correct, yeah.
What was the difference in culture, would you say, between both companies?
I think, I mean, Deliveroo is an environment that is super fun. And it's super fun, so it attracts really, really enthusiastic individuals who really believe in the company's mission and make it a great environment to work in. And Bird and Bird is fun, and most law firms are fun in their own right, but it's slightly different in that you are always focused on an external client that you are either advising or helping in some respect. So you're always mindful of that. And I think that's probably the biggest cultural difference.
Nice. I like that. I guess, yeah, you're right. You are external clients at Bird and Bird, whereas Deliveroo, you're working for Deliveroo.
Correct. You do have internal clients as well. And, you know, especially if you're in the legal team, the level of customer service that is expected of you internally, I mean, wouldn't be anything less than you would be expecting to deliver at a law firm. It's just that you're mindful of different things. There are kind of different commercial considerations and that sort of things. Different things matter if you're working in-house versus if you're working in private practice.
So as a lawyer, who would you say, it's a two-part question, who would you say are your key stakeholders that you deal with on a daily basis in general? And the second part to that question is, what would be some of the skills you would need to deal with these stakeholders?
So again, it kind of depends where you're working. If you're working, so I'll answer kind of from a private practice perspective and from an in-house perspective. So yeah. The first part of the question was, who would be your key stakeholders? If you are working in a law firm, especially if you're a junior lawyer, your key stakeholders will be your seniors. So your senior associates and your partners, and of course, external clients. So, you know, the way it works is typically a funnel. So you'll get your work from somebody who is slightly more qualified than you, whether that's a senior associate or a partner, and you'll work alongside them to produce something that is either advice or something that's to be sent out to clients. And in that respect, you're kind of managing your workload relative to their expectations. So yeah, those would be your key stakeholders in that respect. If you're working in an in-house environment, your key stakeholders tend to be the business. So for instance, if your marketing team has come to you and said, can you help us review this agreement? We're thinking of, you know, signing a commercial agreement with this third party. They're your key stakeholders in that respect. Delivering good quality, accurate work on time, thinking commercially about how the decisions that, you know, you have the business, that the business makes affects it later down the line, and thinking commercially even further about how the terms in the legal agreement that you're reviewing will have a commercial impact on the business going further down the line. So those would kind of be your key stakeholders.
I can definitely see the difference now between both. And I guess it's interesting, at least, you know, you've had a bit of both. So tell us a little bit more about Deliveroo. What was that like? What was like the highlights of your time there?
I think one of the highlights has to be the people. I mean, it's I worked in a phenomenal legal team there. And I think the whole culture there, you know, it's so much fun. Everybody is doing something that's really exciting, and it's kind of cutting edge. And then from a technical perspective, I think the highlights were the type of law that we were doing hadn't really been done before, kind of last mile delivery logistics and opening up in new markets and thinking about how we replicate Deliveroo's model in different markets from an expansion perspective, and advising on lots of different commercial relationships that hadn't previously existed, and thinking through what the legal implications of any new kind of commercial stream that Deliveroo wanted to bring into the market was all really exciting stuff. I mean, you don't really get a chance to do that in many other areas of law, where you are literally inventing a new industry, if you like. And that's kind of what Deliveroo did.
Nice. These startups, this is what's always so interesting about them, creating and inventing, which is a word, creating, that's a word you used at the start in a quick fly round. So I can see why you were having a good time there. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. That was very much kind of like an entrepreneurial environment. And one that I very much enjoyed.
Wow. Nice. So what was the title of your role at Deliveroo?
Legal counsel.
Legal counsel. Okay. Were you part of a team?
I was, yeah. So when I joined, it was probably around 13, 14. I think by the time I left, it was around 20. So,
ooh, good growth.
Yeah. Expanding team.
And what was that like? Was that a bigger, comparing it back to Bird and Bird, was that a bigger or a smaller team to where you've come from?
It was a much smaller team relative to a law firm.
Yeah.
But relative to other in-house legal teams, in my experience, it's quite big to have that many people working in the legal department. But Deliveroo's legal department was quite compartmentalized. So you had a corporate team, a commercial team, a privacy team, and an employment team. So you had sort of sub teams that, you know, managed different parts of, you know, Deliveroo's legal need.
Mm. Nice. Okay. So what comes next after that? What makes you I'm guessing you left Deliveroo, right?
I did, yeah. So I have always been interested and have kind of been educated, from a legal perspective anyway, in venture capital and corporate venture capital. So that's kind of where I wanted to end up. And so a job opportunity with Entrepreneur First came up. And what struck me most about their model is how much potential it had to open up, you know, setting up a business to people who weren't from backgrounds that traditionally set up businesses. So the whole project and the founders and, you know, to be honest, didn't really take much convincing. It was something that I didn't really know existed before they got in contact with me and I interviewed with them. So it's just an incredible company to work for.
Tell us a little bit about a typical day at Entrepreneur First. You go into the, things have changed because in the past you were going to the office, but I'm guessing you're working from home now, right?
Yeah, correct.
So let's try and think back to those days when we're all in the office. You went into the office, what's happening? You know, do you get your coffee, get your breakfast? What's a typical day like?
A typical day is get in. I'm not a massive coffee drinker, so usually fire up the laptop and we have a morning meeting where we talk about sort of things that everybody is working on in my team. So the way the team's structured is you've got a general counsel and then you've got a kind of program delivery / corporate venture capital team that I help look after. So we'll talk about things like what we're all doing, and the idea is to make sure that all bases are covered. The legal team in most businesses is a pretty central function to everything going smoothly, and I'll go on to talk about kind of Entrepreneur First's background and what it does shortly. But the legal team is super central to Entrepreneur First to keep things ticking over. You know, we make investments every day and there's a lot of paperwork that goes on behind the scenes. And there are a lot of questions that come from our team internally and from our founders externally that we need to be able to answer and deliver for the team and for the business on.
Would you say your day, this is just a quick question and then it'd be good to hear about Entrepreneur First, but would you say your day, are your days quite long? are there deadlines that sometimes just come out of nowhere, or would you, are they very cyclical? Do you know what I mean? Can you say this is what's going to happen this week, or will something just pop up?
No, I don't think you can say this is what's going to happen this week. And it will make a lot more sense, you know, in a minute when I discuss what Entrepreneur First does. But you kind of have to be prepared for all types of different tasks and different questions. The day will vary in accordance with the kind of workload that you have. But what I find with Entrepreneur First is you're expected as an adult to manage your workload in a way that makes sense for you, but allows you to meet deadlines if there are any. So in the same way that, you know, you're at university and you get given an essay deadline or an assignment deadline, it's very rare that your lecturers are checking in on you every day to kind of to see how you're doing it. And it's quite nice to be able to have that in a working environment where, you know, you have a level of autonomy that allows you to perform in a way that you know works best for you.
That's great. So I definitely think, tell us a bit about Entrepreneur First.
Sure. So Entrepreneur First is kind of a talent investor. In fact, it's not kind of a talent investor. It is a talent investor. And it's the kind of first of its kind in Europe. And to be honest, really the first of its kind anywhere. So what it does, it invites people with what we call an edge to join its program. So using London as an example, we'll run two cohorts a year, and let's say up to 50 people join a cohort. And these individuals with edges, which we define as kind of unfair advantages versus the rest of the population, go on to form companies. So they join the program pre-idea and pre-company formation. So they're just at this stage exceptional individuals who we've kind of vetted, interviewed and invited to join. And the idea is that they will work with other founders on their cohort and come up with exceptional ideas. Those exceptional ideas will kind of be pitched at our investment committee roughly halfway through the program. And we'll then decide which companies we want to invest in or not. So whilst you're on the program, deciding and coming up with your business, which we call the form part of the program, which lasts for roughly eight to 10 weeks, Entrepreneur First will kind of pay you a stipend, kind of like a monthly stipend to help cover your expenses whilst you're there.
Well, that sort of also makes it easier because, you know, some of the factors that entrepreneurs find difficult is working and building their dreams. Do you know what I mean? So now this sort of like gets rid of that factor of, you know, I need a living wage, basically. I need to live.
So correct. So that was one of the things that really spoke to me in the interview. So the way I see it, a lot of the reason why many Black founders or many, you know, people from BAME backgrounds don't end up starting companies is because it's super risky to start a company if you're not already from wealth, if you don't know it's going to work. So EF is a way that you could potentially de-risk the route to starting your own business by saying, we'll support you to cover some of your expenses and stuff whilst you're trying to build a business because we believe in you as the individual. So that for me was one of the really great potential areas where it could level the playing field a bit. So I was really kind of attracted to that as a concept.
Yes, getting rid of that barrier that's kind of not helping a lot of people to even get to the level where they could even achieve what they
You have some of the most entrepreneurial people in the country who come from our community, and you know, if there is anything that gives them the opportunity to think, right, I'm going to take a plunge and start a business and go out on my own, I'm all for it.
Love that. So would you say that concept and the ethos and mission statement for Entrepreneur First was another factor that helped you decide to want to work there as well?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I didn't know a great deal about how that mission statement would be applied when I was interviewing for EF, but I did see the potential in how it could be used. And, you know, I've tried to kind of do some work with the Diversity and Inclusion Committee at Entrepreneur First and think about how do we, you know, get the most out of this mission statement. It's such an incredible opportunity that we have to really get the best people, and go against the grain of you can only start a business if you're from a specific circumstance, which, you know, no one says explicitly, but tends to kind of manifest in practice.
So for me as an accountant, when I go to interviews, I tend to do the first interview and possibly they'll give me some sort of either Excel or financial modeling test or some sort of numerical financy test to do. And I'll then have maybe a second interview and possibly a third interview with, you know, different people in the team or the business. So I guess my question to you is, what's a typical solicitor lawyer interview?
What I think it depends where you're going and the stage of the business that you're going to. So I've had kind of different interviews at different stages with both law firms and in-house outfits and, you know, tech companies. And typically first round interviews are just kind of like a personal interview, like a cultural fit, that sort of thing. A second round interview tends to be more technical, especially as you become more qualified. So you might be asked to review an email or review some documents. In my kind of industry in venture capital, it may be that you're asked to look at a term sheet, which is a summary of terms on which an investor is looking to make an investment into a company. And they'll ask you to pick up on some of the commercial points in that term sheet and pick up on anything that's potentially missing. And then you'll have to kind of discuss your ideas and go through them. And I guess the idea is to come up with commercially reasonable answers for why you've made certain points or highlighted certain things. And then later stage interviews tend to be more kind of team driven. So what are your motivations and how would you work within our team? And then the final stage is typically meeting the team. I guess really so the team can give some feedback on you and the energy and vibe that they get from you. And that tends to be how it goes. It will vary company to company, but that's kind of, I guess, a broad structure.
Yeah. Nice. That's good. That's good to know, because I do think sometimes this is knowledge people don't really know. And especially if it's maybe your first sort of interview, you might not be aware of what you can prep for, what you're getting into. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. So it sounds like you've worked us all the way up to today. Am I right?
I have. Yeah, I have.
Nice. And you're enjoying yourself at Entrepreneur First?
Very much so, yeah. It's busy, but it's an exciting company. It's kind of growing, obviously coronavirus permitting, but there's some real exciting opportunities, I think, in the next 5 years. So very much, very much happy. And they're supportive of kind of the business that I run on the side as well, which makes a huge difference.
Yes. And we are definitely going to get into that because it's quite interesting. So I can't wait. This has been great. I think it's a good time now to dive into part three, which is all about being black and the podcast name, The Black Ladder. So let's go. Cool. We're back with part three of the Black Ladder podcast, and we're going to be talking with Kenzo about how being black has affected his career. So I'm going to switch it up a little, actually. I was online when I was prepping for this, and I saw this statistic. That word is so difficult for me to say. And the statistic was that in the UK, 3% of solicitors are black. What are your thoughts on that? And why do you think that is?
Well, I think immediately it is sort of like a really horrible statistic when you kind of put it like that. And my lived experience, I guess, has been very much reflective of that. Like, I haven't worked with very many Black lawyers at all. At one point at Burn & Bird, I think I was the only qualified Black lawyer in the London office. So yeah, it's definitely been a lived experience for sure. Why do I think that happens? I think it's kind of symptomatic of certain industries having certain criteria that maybe cuts people out. So for instance, if you have a recruitment policy that only recruits from certain universities, and that university's kind of diversity statistics for a specific area or discipline like law, you know, isn't great, then that's gonna reflect in the jobs that you're in your workforce, I guess. Also, I think, you know, if you're from like me, for instance, I wasn't from a background that could, you know, afford to have paid for law school if I didn't have a sponsor like Burn & Bird. So yeah. I just wouldn't have gone. So I'm sure that there are lots of people from not just black backgrounds, but underprivileged backgrounds, and that don't have that opportunity just because of the financial restriction. And then I guess the last thing I would say, and I have absolutely no data for this at all, is when I was in a state school in London, we didn't really have, you know, being a lawyer or being a doctor or an accountant as the kind of forefront of our career mindset at that time. And that might be because there were no people kind of coming in and sort of giving careers talks who understood where, you know, we came from and understood what our backgrounds were, or even kind of looked in any way remotely like us. So I think those three things factored together might provide some evidence as to why we don't tend to see you know, a proportionately high number of or even reflective of the kind of UK populations Black community in law. We're probably underrepresented, if anything.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, time and time again, when I've asked different guests that question about their, you know, respective careers, the results are coming out that it's starting even before you get to interview stage. Sometimes it's even starting in maybe primary schools, where the differences are already highlighted. And so you're not already going to be, if let's say there's some subjects you don't do, you're already not going to be able to get to do an A level or get to the uni or get to the, which means that the job won't hire you, go to your uni. Do you get what I mean? What I'm trying to say is it starts from way back then. Like, it could even start from like around the age of 6, as far as I'm concerned. It just shows that it's institutionally woven through. Like, there's so many different layers to this thing.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think if you looked at the kind of realistic career roadmaps, nobody, as I said earlier, is probably explicitly saying you can't be a lawyer. But for the people who end up being lawyers, it's not necessarily, you know, an explicit example, but it's more kind of like precedent in the home. Maybe somebody in their family is already a lawyer and they sort of say, oh, what do you do for a living? And when they get to 13, 14, and they're more cognizant of, you know, what that career means, and they can kind of soak up ideas about what people do in their day-to-day jobs, all of those external influences when you're younger kind of put that and prime you into thinking that that's a realistic career option for me. So if you haven't grown up around that, or if your teachers aren't sort of explaining to you that here's an option, or if your parents aren't sort of explaining to you that here is an option, then you're not really alive to it. You may not even know it exists as a career choice for you, and that might make you, that might rule that out for you even before you've properly considered whether it's right for you.
Yeah. And that's exactly why this podcast for me, because I'm saying, you know what, I'm going to get that information off Kenzo about how to be a lawyer. I'm going to give it to everyone. So it's not that it's not out there, because sometimes only, it's not even that people are hiding it, it's just that other people might not be aware of it. So thanks for being on the podcast.
No, I think it's an amazing podcast, and I like really, really like what you're doing in terms of giving, you know, or exposing certain careers. I think it's super helpful to debunk certain myths. So to be clear, when I was probably around 15, 16, I thought you got paid to go to university. I had no idea. I turned up, you know, at sixth form, and I was like, where is the bag for uni? Where is the P? So yeah, like if you don't have certain things or people around you, it's difficult to kind of navigate your way through in a way that makes you decisive about things that you're going to do. You know, speaking to a lot of friends when we were 16, 17, a lot of people say, oh yeah, I don't really know what I'm going to do, but that's different from someone from maybe my background saying, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, if you say, I don't know what I'm going to do, but you know, your parents are really successful, and that's not always the case, but your parents are kind of showing you a way, or at least giving you a precedent of some options, you know, that's a, I guess, a safer position to be in.
Completely agree. You have something to fall back on sometimes, for sure.
Yeah, so, and that's not to say that, you know, your parents, in whatever industry they are going to or are even capable of just getting you a job or anything like that. You're still going to have to work hard no matter who you are.
And, yep.
You know, that's not to invalidate nepotism or, you know, legs up that people get. But more often than not, even if you have gotten a job because your dad or your uncle or sister has put you in that position, if you're not working hard when you get there, you'll get found out. So, you know, you still will have to work hard wherever you go.
That's true. So I guess maybe I'll ask you the general question now, just to get your own views. How has being Black affected your career to date?
It's quite a difficult question to answer, because I've in no way ever felt inferior to anybody due to my color, and that might be kind of misplaced confidence, but yeah, I've just always taken that approach. I realize that not everybody will take that approach, so for me, I've kind of just had confidence in what I'm capable of doing, irrespective of whether other people can see it at the time or not. And I've worked towards what I want to achieve. So I think, I don't know if being Black has affected me in terms of not being able to achieve what I want to achieve, but it certainly has affected other parts of my career. So for instance, if there are no, you know, Black people or, you know, people of color really in an environment where you're working, you know, there's not really a precedent for progression, or at least an optical one. So you can't really say sort of like, okay, this person's from my background, so I know that it's possible for me to get there. You know, you, irrespective of whether a ceiling is glass or not, you might not even know if there's a, you know, there's a ceiling or a limit that you can reach at all. So I think representation in that respect is kind of important. And I say, you might not know if there's a ceiling that you can reach. You might not know if there's anything that you need to smash through, if that makes sense, to kind of get to where you want to go. So as I say, representation is super important. Even just things like, how do you, I think I read somewhere that people of color and women often struggle to kind of negotiate salaries in a way that reflects their value. And like without precedents in the workplace, so things like that might be difficult. Being able to go and have a chat with somebody and sort of saying, look, I think I've been working really hard and I deserve this. Is this going to be really punchy for me to ask for, or is this fairly normal? Things like that, you know, will make a massive difference. So it's almost like, how has being black affected my legal career? I would almost have more data if there were more black people.
Yes.
Working.
That's an interesting view.
In the same environment.
Yeah. That's a very interesting view. Yeah, I do.
Well, yeah, you just have more potential guidance.
Yeah.
In your career. I mean, exactly. You know, and that's not to say that, you know, that kind of always happens. If you are over, or if you are represented in a certain industry, there is an element of, I think, you know, you have to believe in yourself a bit. You can't wait for somebody else to believe in you. And with that mentality, I think you kind of tend to make decisions in a way that will sometimes lead to much better outcomes if, you know, you don't have lots of self-doubt kind of informing your decisions all the time.
Yes. Before we wrap up, I'd love to hear a little bit more about 40 Cards.
Sure.
So tell us all about it, because I think it's such an interesting concept.
So 40s was started, I was actually on holiday with one of my best friends who is fairly senior in the digital marketing world at Facebook. And a lot of the time that we spend together, not just with him, but with other friends as well, is talking about kind of topics, issues, statements that, you know, we find interesting, but that you don't typically get a chance to discuss generally. So last year, after that holiday, I decided to just go for it. Why don't we put 40 of these topic statements and issues on a deck of cards and get them manufactured and see how they sell on Amazon, see whether other people are keen to kind of join in the conversation. And the basis for this is you can't really say you understand the world unless you understand more than just your perspective of it, if that makes sense. So the cards and the statements are designed to provoke conversation and to provoke different ways of thinking with the aim of allowing you to ultimately expand your echo chamber. So it might be things like education should never be linked to wealth, discuss, or how do we feel about colloquial use of the N-word, discuss. It really kind of gets you thinking in a more adversarial way than you might otherwise have had a conversation with somebody.
Yeah, how fun. I like that idea so much. And where can the game be found?
So at the moment, you can get it on our website, 40cards.com. So you can get one through there. But we're just about to do a crowdfunding campaign, which should be launching in mid-October. So the cards are great, and the cards are all about accessibility. So the idea is to, you know, get a pack of cards into every home in the country by the end of the year. Ambitious, but that's kind of like what we want to aim for.
You have to, yeah, for sure.
But the cards, kind of the topics and statements of the cards are really interesting, and we want to cover them in more depth. So what we're crowdfunding for is to be able to produce some short films and some short documentaries where we dive deeper into these topics. So we're going to do a three-part mini-series we're going to cover monogamy as a concept and whether it's still relevant for modern society. We're going to cover growing up in a religious household. So I'm from Nigeria, and you know, growing up in a religious household, how that affects you, your decisions and your life, and whether you're going to carry on those traditions in the future. And also going to touch on cancel culture as well. So one of the cards that we've got on in our deck is, you should only judge an individual's actions by the socially acceptable standards of the time they took place. And that kind of really speaks to cancel culture. And it's an interesting debate, actually, when you get into it, you know, whether things that people do today are, you know, reflective of how they grew up, or and whether they should be immediately cancelled for things that don't align with social standards today, but have been kind of ingrained with them for a long time. And that's one that gets debates firing and stuff like that. So we want to, you know, interview some people and dive deeper into that topic. So the crowdfunding campaign will be kind of launched in mid-October. So we encourage everybody to please donate to that. And you will get kind of an original deck of 40 in return, for sure. Yeah, it's an exciting time, and that's leading up to Christmas as well.
Yes, everyone can. Oh, that would be controversial for Christmas dinner, don't you think?
Aunties, yeah. Uncle. Oh, God, but played cross-generationally is actually one of the best times to play. So, yeah, we've been really surprised and delighted with the response that we've received. So we've been covered in a couple of national newspapers. And we've got we've got some promotion coming out with Time Out London as well, later in the year. So
this is great. Definitely check it out, everyone.
Yeah.
What a nice way to wrap up part three of the podcast. So we're back with part four of the Black Ladder podcast, and so Kenzo's going to give us some top tips and advice. So I guess, Kenzo, you are climbing this career ladder, you've worked your way up, Bird and Bird, delivery. As you look back down this career ladder, what are the top tips and advice you want to leave for the next person who wants to do, or who wants to be where you are now?
The first tip that I would give is, value yourself and your skill set and your interests. Not every place that you apply to is going to be right for you. It's a two-way process. So, you know, let's say you are interested in sports and technology, there'll be a law firm or, you know, a career that fits those interests. And when you come across that and you find that, it'll be a lot easier for you to come across as convincing in an interview as to why you want to work for a specific organization. So, you know, cherry pick where you're applying and really do your research and figure out whether that is the best place for you. And I guess the second bit of advice I would give is just kind of believe in yourself, even when other people aren't obviously believing in you. You know, nobody's going to know better than you what you're capable of doing. So kind of have faith in your skill set and your abilities, and you know, I'm sure that will lead to positive outcomes. Finally, I don't think you can kind of go too far wrong from just being positive and being nice and providing a decent, you know, customer service in whatever area that you're working in. I think, you know, people appreciate that. And if you can, if people can look at you and think, right, you know, I'm always going to get a positive outcome working with that person, I think, you know, it stands you in good stead to go further. That's not to say that when you need to be firm, you know, you shouldn't be. You absolutely should. But it's just to say that, you know, try and be one of those people that you look to at work that everyone sort of thinks that's a good person to work with.
Yes. I like that tip. That's a really nice, that third one's really lovely. And I think it's one that's easily forgotten as well sometimes with the stresses of work and life, you know, it can be easily forgotten. We've come to the end of the podcast, unfortunately, but it would be really great if we can find out more about where can people find you? Where can they get in touch? If anyone has a question about being a solicitor, working in a legal department, or just doing training to become a solicitor, where can people find you and reach out to you?
Yeah, so anyone can drop me an email at kenzo@40cards.com. So that's probably the quickest way to email me. And if you are, yeah, if you've got any questions on law or setting up a business or otherwise, yeah, drop me an email there. And everyone, follow 40. Our Instagram handle is @follow40. So yeah, please do join us on our journey.
Yes, I'll be putting the details all in the bio of the podcast, so you can check that out there. And don't forget to crowdfunding, right?
Yeah, so that will be kind of launched in mid-October. So yeah.
Excited to see that. That'll be really interesting. So thank you so much, Kenzo. It's been so great. This has been such a seamless interview. Like, I can't, even now, I don't know how much editing I have to do. It's really been great.
Awesome. No pleasure. And thank you very much, Ifa, for setting this up.
For sure. Don't forget to share and subscribe to the Black Ladder podcast. It's available on all podcast platforms.